We now have a roughly 15-minute time slot for questions and answers. So for the three speakers we had for the first half of the seminar, I would like them just to, I guess we'll pass around the mic amongst us, and you guys can ask questions. The mics also, Manly is managing your left, my right. And over here we've got Todd on the microphone already.
Hi, everybody. Louise, I have a question regarding, over here, up there, there we go. I have a question regarding the setup of your process for the G20 and the G8. How much information do you get from previous conferences, or do you have to reinvent all of this from the ground up, depending on where you're working?
That's a great question. The Kananaskis conference was in Alberta, gosh, what was it, 10 years before that? Or it must have been 8 years before that, because it rotates through from G8. We had some of their information, but a lot of it was outdated. Like, it was helpful to get the approach from them and some of the communications and learn from some of the, they do a debriefing after that. So that was really, really helpful to see what they had done. And we kind of used that to begin with as our Bible. That would have been around 6 or 7 huge binders full of information as to what they had done before. But ours was a little bit different because in emergency medicine, there's been a lot of advances in the space of that 10-year period of time. There was never, as I said, the G8 and G20 together, so it was much more complex. And also, I have to say, with President Obama, it was very different, apparently, versus other presidents. He attracted more crowds, so there was even more concerns about security. So we did use older material to help buff it up. We spoke to some folks down in Philadelphia because there had been a recent G20 meeting in Philadelphia as well, and did a site visit there to see what they were doing.
Thanks. And Mike, I have one more question, then I'll give the mic up, I promise. Where do you get your funding for your missions?
The funding, what happens is you pay a participation fee as a volunteer yourself, which includes the flights and your accommodations and your meals and things like that, which roughly runs somewhere around $3,500 to $4,000 per individual. And so you pay that to the organization, and then you get a charitable receipt back from the organization. So some people will get funding from their local church or community to be a participant, or other people pay it on their own. So a lot of that, those trips are funded through the volunteers.
Thanks.
This is for Louise. Do you have some sort of idea before the leaders arrive as to what their medical problems are, and are they checked out before they go on these missions?
Yeah. I'm not sure. Oh, I am on. Okay. Yeah, this was something that was very important. We would speak for the G8 folks. We spoke to their private physicians to get more information. The leaders of all the organizations sent their medical information to us so that we could make arrangements both for food issues and also for medical issues to make sure that we were completely staffed for eventualities. That being said, if you've got somebody who's in their early 70s with, in quotation marks, no medical history, are no medical problems, you have to kind of take that with a grain of salt. I think there was a lot of information that was held back to a certain extent because there's always worries that confidentiality could never completely be respected no matter what they did. So yes, we did get information about medical history, but I have to say that I kind of, you know, if there was something really, really, in quotation marks, good there, then I was able to deal with it. But if there wasn't much there, then you had to kind of use your imagination.
And I have a question for Rob. Do you have any females in your patients, in female patients? Or do you advocate men only having men psychiatrists and females?
Not at all. I have plenty of women in my practice. It's just kind of a statistical anomaly that I've found many men to kind of float my way. But you know, there are plenty of men who don't want to work with a male therapist or doctor. And it's the same for women that, you know, it really depends on what their comfort level is. But I would say the split is probably about 50-50.
Good morning. I have a question for Dr. Michael Murphy. I'm from New York City, New York Eye and Ear Infirmary, and our eye guys do a lot of these type of trips. But on the ear side of things, the postoperative care is really important. It's probably as important as any surgery going on. I'm just wondering, do you train any of your local doctors in providing the care, and what is their level of skill set? We have had two doctors from Ethiopia come and each spent 3 months with us in New York, and they took temporal bone dissection, they observed in the operating room. I must tell you, their skill sets took an enormous leap upward. Not that they could take first world technology and transport it, but they could really use a lot of the techniques they learned back in Ethiopia. Just wondering if you have any experience with that.
Well, we often do use local support, and often they're physicians themselves that then provide that, or we liaise with other local ophthalmologists. There are some of the trips that we're training some of the residents of the country itself, and we'll make sure that they have often a contact if they develop postoperative complications after we go away, normally in the form of a local ophthalmologist, or depending, for instance, in Burma, that would have been a 6-hour car ride to Rangoon to get somebody. But often we'll have some of those contacts, and that's some of the legwork that's done prior to trying to start the mission itself.
I got a couple of questions. Rob, with Dominique, did you get any stock options in his company?
I wish I had. He really, I cannot, if I divulge any information, it would actually reveal what the product was. It was actually a product that went from, I think his company was a $2 million company, it went to a $300 million company. And this was if he wasn't there, it may have made it half that distance. But I literally did get a coffee every time. it was interesting because the day that he fired me, and it actually, we were able to talk through, it wasn't like, you're a piece of crap, you haven't helped me, goodbye. I mean, we were able to talk about it. But the day he fired me, he did not bring me a coffee. But at every other visit, from that seminal visit to when he fired me, he brought a big coffee, stack of napkins, all that.
Question for Mike. And by the way, very nice glasses. Oh, there you are. obviously, the missions were very eye-centric. I'm a pediatrician, and I was wondering, what are the opportunities specifically with your group for other specialties?
Well, if you know how to sweep a broom, it'd be fine. There are numerous opportunities. The flagship is the ophthalmological care, but they do have medical care, surgical care, dental care. But when you're in a 2-week window, you really need to focus, pardon the pun, on something that you can go in, blitz, and come out. And so obviously a surgical subspecialty is something that provides that opportunity, where less so in the medical field where you're dealing with the importance of immunizations or care or things like that. But once you go, you're slotted in. I've been a variety of different positions throughout, or stations throughout the different trips that I've been on. So you may not function as a pediatrician, but you'd be able to function as part of a valued member. And certainly there are times as the family doctor that I've been administering to health of general health of either volunteers or people that come in for different care. So you'd be able to do a bit of that. But I'm sure there are a variety of other organizations that perhaps focus on pediatrics. But certainly, they're all from all walks of life. You have people that are medical, non-medical. Everybody gets a job. The first couple of days, you're learning by the seat of your pants, and then afterwards, you're part of that well-oiled machine that has that job, and people click through the system. You can imagine when you have 75 volunteers and 750 people going through. Sometimes we'll have artificial eyes or a variety of different subspecialties that they're able to provide a lot of care. You become very good at your particular station.
Thanks. And just for Luis, you know, you talked to us about a very intense 8-month period in your life. How have you used that since that time in what you do now? And explain what you do now.
Okay. It's kind of hard to explain. There are a few things. Number one, I get called back once in a while if they have a small state visit that occurs, so I can, you know, kind of give advice, or I might serve as the physician on call if anything occurs. Because if you've only got one head of state coming in, you don't really need a clinic. You don't really need all this rigmarole. So I do that. I was asked by the Governor General to be on the Bravery Committee. So I'm the physician that sits on the Bravery Committee. And I have a feeling that maybe that was related to it. It's either that or the coroner. They never told me why. But you know, our Governor General is our previous, is it principal of McGill or?
Daniel Johnson.
Chancellor? Sorry?
Principal.
Principal, yeah. So he was our principal, so I don't know if that had a bit of an in as well, living in Ottawa, and he's looked at all the grads and figured out who he could slot in. I don't know. But that has really been something. And then the other thing that I do is I'm the Champlain Emergency Services network lead. So for our local health integrated networks, there's 16, 17 emergency departments. And kind of getting them all to work together with the paramedic services and the rest of the healthcare services that do emergency stuff. So I would say that certainly helped, because there's a whole heck of a lot of negotiations that was going on for that senior medical advisor. There was a bit that was medical, there was a bit that was organizational, and there was a whole heck of a lot that was sitting down, talking, listening to people, convincing them of things sometimes. You know, that I think it was the people skills that I brought out more than anything else. That's it. Thanks, Phil.
Someone else question?
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't there. One thing you have to realize is every province has a different coroner system. In Ontario, coroners are physicians. In BC, they're all non-physicians. You know, in Quebec, it's a mix of lawyers and physicians. So the coroner job didn't really have anything to do with the G8 and the G20. The coroner job for me has more to do with public safety and protecting the people of Ontario, like going in and finding out what could prevent deaths in similar circumstances. So that's a little off to the side.
About the ophthalmology, I just wanted to know, what would a family doctor be doing while everybody's operating eyes?
Well, you're part of a whole team, and again, you're involved with each station. So, the 1 year I was a scrub nurse as a family doctor, but the rest of the time I was not in the operating room at all.
So, what was your role? That's what I was questioning.
So, one of the roles was at the screening. So, when you see a patient with the 20/200 vision, then you're using the ophthalmoscope and your pen light to determine if they have a refractive problem, medical problem, or surgical problem. And then you form them out to the different forks after that. I was involved with the fitting of the glasses and talking to people and trying to do that. So, you know, your role really is varied, and you're part of a member of a team. And I didn't really care what my role was. It's just trying to work through providing that care and being part of the team approach. So you take on a whole bunch of different roles.
In Ontario, they delisted eye exams for adults. And so the more nearsighted you get, the more you get coverage. So what is
No. No, this was solely based on developing countries. So we're not involved in any of the local developed countries and how they manage health eye care there.
All right.
Louise, just a quick question. What is the Bravery Committee?
Oh, so glad you asked. there are bravery awards. There's the Medal of Bravery, the Cross, and the Star of Bravery. It's a Canada-wide award. It was established in 1972 for acts of bravery, where you put yourself at risk to save the life of another person. Yeah. Actually, there were two docs that received it yesterday because I was at the ceremony yesterday. And both of them dove into a lake that was full of shards of, there had been just been a boat crash, shards of glass, noxious fumes, boat was on fire, went underneath and rescued a guy, got him, you know, kind of ripped out of where he'd been stuck, brought him up to the top of the boat and resuscitated him. Okay, they got a bravery award. But the stuff we do in the Emerge, I love it, but, you know, we're not really absolutely putting ourselves at that much risk. But we do love what we do.
No burning boats in ERs, I guess not. Okay, we have a break now until officially 10:40. Gives us 25 minutes to get some coffee, go to the bathroom, massage your fragile male ego, and we'll be back at 10:40.
Yeah, I loved it when you said, well, we know that men are more fragile and sensitive.